This is issue 2 of the Crit Hit Audio Zine. It's launch day. That's right. Our campaign for Crit Hit 4, the Summer of Summoning, launched today, and I wanted to give you guys an update on how that's going. And on the back half of the issue, I want to go ahead and talk about a game that I always bring up when it comes to fantasy role-playing games, and that's the amazing Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells on issue 2 of the Crit Hit Audio Zine. This is the Crit Hit Audio Zine. All right, so it is launch day of Crit Hit 4, the Summer of Summoning. And we've been live as of this recording for about 6 hours, and we're about 40% funded. One of the purposes of me doing updates about Crit Hit on here was to keep sort of an audio diary and give people in the community, in our community, a little bit of an insight of what it's like to run a Kickstarter, what it's like to organize a convention, what it's like to plan, and all the things that sort of go into making something like Crit Hit happen. And there's a lot of work, there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of tears, a lot of blood, a lot of sweat that go into this. And but this has been such a strong first day for Crit Hit that it's a little overwhelming. I can't believe that 6 hours in, we're about halfway funded with this thing. And I'm really hoping that we do well, and that, you know, if we overfund, I got to start thinking about maybe some stretch goals and how we're going to improve Crit Hit a little bit. But I did want to talk about some of the stuff that's kind of going on this day one launch and what it's like to launch a Kickstarter. First of all, if you've never run a Kickstarter, it involves a lot of basically you obsessively clicking on the refresh button, right? You're clicking on the refresh button for however long your Crit Hit, or your credit, for however long your Kickstarter runs, right? For me, it's going to be 45 days of doing nothing but checking my phone every 5 minutes, clicking the refresh button every 5 minutes, you know, getting frustrated at that dip that happens in the middle of a Kickstarter where nothing moves and you think everything's going to fail. Like, that's what doing a Kickstarter is all about. It's about trying to do the prep work and trying to get it out there and trying to make sure, and in our case, hope that everything we've done in the last 3 years, you know, going on 4 years of building a community around tabletop gaming with a heavy emphasis on role-playing games pays off. And so far it looks like it has, just based on the responses that we've gotten at our Kickstarter. And it's little things, man, like you wake up, right? Like you wake up way earlier than you should have. I woke up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, just shot up out of bed. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was just like excitement or nervousness or anxiousness or what, but I just woke up just dead awake. I had to force myself to go back to sleep because I had to have to work on Saturdays, and today is Saturday. But I can tell you that once we launched, you know, right away, we started off strong. It's been incredible. Launching a Kickstarter and having a Kickstarter live, a lot of it is the way that I do it, unfortunately, is adjustment as we go. I have a pretty full life. You know, we have a family and kids and commitments and this and that and friends and things like that. So sometimes, you know, I put something out there and I have to do adjustments as I go. The Kickstarter has adjustments that has to be made to it. Unfortunately, there were some things that, like, once somebody's pledged on a pledge level, I can't change the pledge level wording at all. So unfortunately, there's some things there I wish I could improve on. But the actual Kickstarter itself, as far as like the story goes, like the quote unquote story is what they call it, I can change that, and I have. And one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting was the messenger bag I called Grigri, and people didn't understand what that was. And so that was kind of interesting. So our messenger bags were calling, the bag of Grigri, and Grigri is a voodoo charm that people make, and it's usually like a little cloth pouch that has something very personal inside of it, right? And that those personal items are what sort of protect you from evil or from harm or from what have you. And that's called a gri-gri. It's like a good luck charm. And so I thought that was, you know, thematically something really cool to call our messenger bags, especially when we have sort of, you know, this horror Lovecraftian sort of culty vibe going this year, to bring like a good luck charm, like something that's going to be good for you and kind of keep you safe. And, you know, we put our gaming books and our dice, and anybody who knows me knows I am like the least, I don't want to say this. I'm the person who believes the least in sort of any kind of supernatural anything. And that's just sort of how I am. Except for, dice. Like, you know, I don't know if it's habit. I don't know if it's genuine superstition or not, but like I have weird little things about, like, I don't stack my dice during a game because it's bad luck. You know, I don't roll my dice, you know, just to roll them because, you know, you're going to wear out the good luck rolls. Right. So I have weird rituals that I attach to my dice, and, you know, I like on the conscious level, I know that that's not a thing, right? Like my conscious brain knows that there's no such thing as luck as far as like my dice, and I'm not going to wear it out. Probability is probability. It's going to do what it's going to do regardless of how many times I roll it. But you know, it's that deep grained sort of culture of gaming. And it's something that I love, of that silly, like, don't mess with your dice or don't do this. Like, everyone has their own little dice rituals. And so there is a certain amount of superstition, you know, not in the deeply rooted sense, but kind of in the playful sense, kind of like I guess people who, you know, like football players will wear like dirty socks or something like that. Like, it's kind of this fun ritual. And so the idea of having a messenger bag that carries our personal items, our books, our pens, our dice, calling it gri-gri, I thought was something that would be kind of cool. And I'm really happy with it. I am surprised we had a poll on Facebook as far as what, how to do these bags. Because my initial plan was to do the bags, in color, like a black bag with a color logo, because we have this wonderfully, beautifully created logo, by Jody Horn. She's one of the vendors, last year, and she's going to come back this year. She's just an incredible artist, and she made this beautiful logo that fucking just blew me away. Like, when I saw it, I was like, whoa, fuck. Like, I want to put that on everything, right? Because I'm a big fucking logo whore. Like, I just throw at everything, right? But it was beautiful. And then my buddy Wonka, he's our security guy. He's like the big guy with all the tattoos and stuff. A real mean looking dude who's like a total sweetheart teddy bear. But I still wouldn't fuck with him, kind of a thing. Which is what you want for security. He's also an extremely talented graphic designer. And so we had the line art from Jody, and Wonka sort of took it on himself to do the colorization of it. And those two creative people working together made the logo something I think that is very next level for us. You know, the initial logo, the C that I did, you know, I created that and because I was a graphic designer in a previous life. But yeah, just having something hand inked brings a totally different flavor to our logo and to our branding that I really loved. So my initial thought was, hey, you know, let's put that on a, you know, let's put it color, man, like do it color on a bag and it'll be fucking cool or whatever. And I put the poll up there but I saw the line art. I did one as a line art, you know, just kind of as a comparison, as a one-off, like not something I was really looking at. I wasn't really looking at doing a line art type, bag at all. That wasn't really a thing. But, you know, I put it on there just because, you know, when you design things, you want to have different looks at things so you can kind of compare and contrast. And sometimes deliberately putting something that you're not crazy about out there brings on a different line of thinking. You know, so you should always try and do something that you're not used to, or isn't your natural instinct, because maybe you'll come up with something cool. So I put the line art on there, and it was funny because, you know, so Wonka is a brilliant merch guy. Like, he makes a bunch of merch for himself and for other people, and he's really, really good at it. And so we were talking about like what the look of, because we're going to do t-shirts this year, for the first year. And we were talking about what the look of the t-shirts was going to be. You know, we kind of were talking about like sort of the punk rock, you know, dirty metal bar aesthetic of Crit Hit. And what we came up with was that we should do just a line art t-shirt, a black t-shirt with the white line art, and you know, and that's it. Just make it look kind of like a punk shirt or like a metal shirt, right? Just very simple. And I kind of dug that. I was like, yeah, that's pretty fucking cool. So let's do that. But I totally did not think about that for the bag. I wanted a color logo for the bag, because we have these beautiful dice that we're doing for the Kickstarters, for free. And we're also going to sell, extra sets. But, so, you know, I was thinking of color, you know, everything should be in color, but, we put the poll up. And overwhelmingly, people went with black and white, which was crazy to me. But then the more I looked at the black and white, and I thought about a black and white bag with sort of a black shirt with the white, you know, line art, and it would just kind of go together as a sort of cool metal punk rock kind of look to it. And I really dug it, and so I'm really happy with it. And yeah, so that was that's kind of a funny story about how the logo going to be inked in white came to be. That was not my original intention. My original vision was color, and it looks great in color. And you know, who knows, maybe if there's a big enough need after the Kickstarter's over, I'll see if I can gather enough money to do a small run of the color ones. But as of right now, everything's gonna be that cool black and white logo that's really strong. So that's a little bit about day one of the Kickstarter for Crit Hit 4 Summer of Summoning. If you haven't backed yet, by all means, you should. We're going to cap this event at 500 people. So it's not going to, you know, it's there's not going to be enough room for everybody. So we're capping it at 5, and we want to stay at 5. And we're committing, as of right now, we're committed to doing 2 years at 500 people. Bigger isn't always better. In some cases it is, but in our case, it's not. We want to maintain a level where we can really focus on the quality of the event as opposed to, just boasting numbers. That's not something that we're interested in doing. We don't talk about how, you know, our square footage or our game library and things like that. Those are not things that interest me, because they're not experience. To me, experience is something cool. Like, you get to hang out with John Wick and have a conversation about, you know, traditional role-playing games versus, you know, their dice mechanics versus, you know, more narrative-based stuff and things like that. It's hanging out with Zach Glazer and the Frog God guys, and they're talking about, you know, their passion of old-school Renaissance gaming. It's about, you know, meeting artists like Jody or like any of the vendors or like the guy from Wild in the Streets who brought out those cool minis, which are like the punk rock minis that like they fight in the street kind of thing. Like, it's about, those are the things that interest me more than like hard numbers. And so to maintain that and foster that, you know, we decided pretty early on in planning for Crit Hit 4 that we were going to cap our attendees at 500. Again, probably not the smartest business decision. You know, I should, you know, if I want to make money at this, I should probably be like, oh, fuck it. You know, I'm going to do as many people as I can get in there. But Crit Hit's not a revenue generating endeavor. It never has been. And any revenue that we do make for this particular event is going to go right back into supporting the staff that is doing, even right now, a wonderful job of putting this together. They're taking a lot off my plate. For the longest time, it's an entire convention run by essentially two people, and they're already kind of taking things off of the plate and making things easier for me to manage and me to focus on some of the bigger issues of Crit Hit. So you know, if we make any extra money, it's going to be to put them up in the night for a hotel, pay for their meals, that kind of thing. That's why we're capping at 500 is to maintain a good feel for the event and to make sure that everyone enjoys themselves, that everyone has a memorable experience. And that's ultimately what's more important than anything else when it comes to Crit Hit, is that experience. So go pledge. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about, we're going to start a series that I'm really excited about. Like I've told people before, I'm shamelessly doing this thing. I don't have an original thought in my head. I just steal other people's shit and then just sort of put a little spin on it as my own of what I want. And, so I was a big fan of a podcast called Spellburn, and Spellburn was amazing. It still is. It's still around. It's still a great podcast. But the early episodes of Spellburn did something that I absolutely fucking fell in love with, which is they're a Dungeon Crawl Classics podcast, and they did this thing where they went through each class and sort of talked about what makes it cool and what makes it work and why it's different in Dungeon Crawl Classics. And I really love that. It's a great guide. Like those early episodes of Spellburn, if you're interested in Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is one of my go-to systems for fantasy, go listen to those, you know, the episodes on like, you know, what a druid is, or, you know, how the thief works and stuff like that. They're fucking great. And so I want to do that with one of my favorite, role-playing systems, Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells. And so on the other side of the break, we're going to talk a little bit about the core mechanic of Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells, how simple it is. And hopefully you'll hear that and you'll go pick up the book. And then we'll do later episodes where we talk about like each class, because there's only three classes, but we'll talk about the mechanics and how that works and how that integrates and why you should go out and play this fucking game, especially since they just got picked up by Gallant Knight Games. So hopefully we're going to see them in print in the US, you know, like at a convention, you can go and pick up a copy for yourself. All right, so stick around and we'll see you on the other side of the break. Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells is by Diogo Nogueira. He's a Brazilian designer, an avid OSR Renaissance man. Like, the guy just loves the OSR. He loves old school role-playing games. And he created this game, Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells, as a rules light sword and sorcery old school role-playing game. It's got a lot of influences of Fate and Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is no surprise because Diogo is responsible for bringing Dungeon Crawl Classics to Brazil. And the game has the fingerprints of both Fate and DCC all over it. As we continue this exploration of the game, you'll see that come out a little bit more. There's a couple of other things in there too. It definitely strives to be an old school feel of a game, so very much in terms with like original D&D and that sort of stuff. And it's also very Conan-esque, right? Like it. He says he draws inspiration by Robert Howard and Clark Ashton Smith and Lovecraft and Moorcock and all those things. And you do see that through the book. It is a very short book. The rules are very light, but you can definitely see that influence in the design of the game. Today, we're going to talk about the core mechanic of the game. So the main thing that you're going to do in this game, which is really interesting, and it works really well. You see it in things like the Black Hack. And in a lot of ways, I really like the Black Hack. But there was always something like a little bit missing for it for me. Like, I couldn't quite point my finger on it. And then when I read Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells, I absolutely fell in love with it. So let's dive right in. The core mechanics of Sharp Swords and Sinister Spell is you roll a d20 against an appropriate attribute. Now, the attributes in Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells are really basic. You have physique, agility, intellect, willpower, and they're all pretty self-explanatory. Between those four attributes, you can make just about any kind of check. So, for example, if you're trying to push a stone off of a cliff, right? Like a big rock, a boulder off of a cliff. That's a physique check. So you just roll your under your physique. So if your physique is a 16, you roll a d20. If you get under a 16, you did the thing. Really easy, really quick, very intuitive. For some people, I know it's a little weird to do this sort of inverse the roll under system, but it works well once you sort of grasp, or once you sort of absorb the whole concept of roll under, and then it makes sense, because the higher your score, the better you are, which means you just have to roll under that. There can be a difficulty modifier that is imposed on it. It can be either a plus or a minus from 1 to 10. This is not something I've used in practice too much. It's in there, and definitely you want to use it to like make things a little bit harder or easier for your players. I think there's other mechanics in this game that we're going to get to in a minute that do that a little bit better. But if you do feel like fine-tuning the game, using a difficulty modifier is definitely there for you. And I'll quickly touch upon, you know, kind of a bigger scope of the rules. These rules are extremely modular. There's a whole nother book called The Addendum, which is a book that's actually a little bit bigger than the core rule book in terms of page count, that has more rules that you can bolt on into this. So by no means is this a very static system. It's made to be modular, and which is a very OSR kind of thing, where you just piecemeal together the system that you want to play. And this game does that very, very well. So again, the difficulty check that you can add to things, you know, plus one, minus one, all the way up to +1, -10 as a modifier, is definitely there. But in practice, I haven't used it too much. It's not something like, again, I think there's other rules that do that better. For example, positive and negative die. Now, this is a great mechanic that's in a lot of newer games. You see it in D&D, where they call it advantage, disadvantage. Call of Cthulhu, I believe, calls it the same thing. And it's basically what it says on the tin. So if you're rolling positive, you take an additional D20 and you roll it, and you're going to take the best score out of the two. If you're rolling negative, you're going to take the worst. The difference here is on a negative die, the referee chooses the best, or chooses the result that he prefers, which is different. So in this case, the GM can say, you know, which of the two dice you're going to take. So the GM sort of decides if you're going to succeed or fail based off of the numbers on the two dice that you roll. So that is an interesting narrative spin where the referee, the GM, gets to take that narrative control. But at the same time, doing something like positive and negative die, or advantage, disadvantage, if you will, for a game like this really makes things easy. It cuts down the math. In my opinion, and this is just my opinion and definitely not Diogo's because he put it in there, but this sort of replaces that whole difficulty modifier. The idea of adding a numerical value to make something more difficult or easy makes sense in a simulation kind of thing, right? You assign a number to it, you quantify it by a number, and then you just add that to the die roll or the target number. But when you're doing something really cinematic, it's much more intuitive. Just go, okay, you know what? This is going to be harder for you. Go ahead and roll disadvantage. You're going to roll, you know, two dice or negative dice in this case. And then as a GM, I can be like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and take the negative one. I'm going to take the worst one, and you're going to fail at this. And I think that's a more interesting mechanic. It's really nice to see that included in something that is so OSR focused or influenced by. And it's this great melding of sort of the old school way of telling stories and playing games in the new school way. And I love having that in there. Something interesting that happens in games often is that people will fail at a roll, and you'll get your players almost every time that they start going, well, I want to try it again. And so they go and they want to roll the die again to see if they succeed, right? They want a second chance. And most times I say, no, you can't. You can try it one chance. And that's kind of a common thing. But Diogo does something interesting in Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells, where you can push the roll. And here's where some of that fate, some of that narrative, some of that modern gaming design really starts to kind of peek its head through into the game. So let's say I'm trying to push this boulder over the cliff because there's orcs or whatever down on the bottom of the cliff, whatever. And I roll and I fail. I can push my roll. And what that says is I will tell the game master basically how I'm going to try it again, or how I'm putting extra effort to do this, you know, even though I just failed at it. And the idea is that I'm risking more of a consequence. So before, if I'm just trying to push a rock and nothing happens, it's sort of a nil value, like nothing happens. But in this case, I'm giving permission to the GM as a player by pushing the roll and saying, I want to try again. I'm giving permission to the GM to give me a consequence that is worse than if I had not attempted it in the first place. And that's a brilliant narrative mechanic that's in this game. And that's the kind of thinking that goes into this game. That's the kind of really great, sharp thought process where you have both that the positive, negative die, or advantage, disadvantage, for all intents and purposes, and pushing the roll. There's a lot of narrative control happening in this game, and it's very subtle, but it's there, and it makes things just go by so much easier and quicker, more intuitive. A couple other things to talk about the core mechanic in this game is you have something called a usage die. Now, you see this in a bunch of other games. I'm a big fan of the usage die. I know it has a lot of its distractors, but I like it, and I like the way that he presents it here. So basically, the usage die is based on the concept of a dice chain. So the dice chain would be the number of sides on a particular die. So a D4, a D6, a D8, D10, D12, D20, etc. When you have something, say, arrows, your arrows, in a typical game, you're doing bookkeeping, and I fucking hate that. I'm not about fucking bookkeeping. I don't want to keep track of arrows. I don't want my players keeping track of arrows. It distracts away from the story. You start thinking about things, you know, very mechanically, and I'm not a big fan of that. So let's say you have an archer, he's shooting arrows, and traditionally you would just check off arrow boxes or some shit like that, right? In Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells, your arrows would be represented by a usage die. The way that I would use it in this game is, for example, you have a combat, boom, 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 you just keep shooting. If I'm a GM and you're the player, I'm going to tell you, just go ahead and keep firing your arrows, and you're all good. Now, maybe if they push their roll, because they fail a shot, I can have them roll usage, right? And the way that rolling your usage die works is you take the die that's assigned to a particular item, so in this case, arrows, and let's say that is a D8. You roll the D8. As long as it's not a 1 or a 2, you still have arrows. However, if it is a 1 or a 2, your die gets downgraded to the next step down on that dice chain. So if you roll a 1 or a 2 on a D8, guess what? Now you have a D6. So the next time that you have to roll for your arrows, you know, there's less of a chance of succeeding. And from D6, it goes to a D4. From a D4, after that, you're done if you fail. So that's a great mechanic that's in there, and it's a beautiful addition to the game. Another thing that's in there is the luck roll. So luck roll is a really cool thing. It works almost like a saving throw. You can use it for like a saving throw or a bunch of other things like that. If you just need your character to be lucky, you roll. And again, as long as it's a not a 1 or a 2, you're good. It works like a usage die. You have the number of sides, D20, D12, D10, and it just works really well, much like a usage die, except this represents your luck. And so that about does it for our look at the core mechanic on Sharp Swords and Sinister Spells. Like us on all our social media and all that good shit. And that's it. Thanks.